Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. NATO's approach towards Ukraine is full of contradictions. We are told a win for Russia is a defeat for the West. But Ukraine is not a member of the military alliance. We're told NATO is not part of the conflict, but it has been supporting Kyiv militarily since 2014. NATO says it wants Russia to be defeated, but it says nothing about peace. Crosstalking NATO's illusions, I'm joined by my guest, Garland Nixon, in Washington. He's a political analyst. And we're thinking we have Anthony Weber. He is an independent political commentator. And in London, we cross to Adi Inka Makinde. He is a visiting lecturer at the Law School of the University of Westminster. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Let's go to Adi Inka in London first here. And in my introduction, that the last sentence I talk about the word peace. This is something that, when watching this conflict in Ukraine, NATO never it mentions the word peace, doesn't want to strive for peace. It wants a defeat of one country, and that it is Russia here. That is a fundamental flaw of the strategy that NATO has. NATO doesn't think about security. It doesn't think geopolitically. It thinks ideologically in a neoliberal way. And this is why it's turned into such a mess for the continent. And the consequences are far, far reaching. The military conflict in Ukraine will come to an end one day, but the implications and the ramifications of what NATO has done will be with us for a very long time. Go ahead in London.
Well, yes, I think this has been reflected in my writings and commentaries on the matter. I think it's clear that, NATO is obviously an extension of U.S. foreign policy. And U.S. foreign policy, in the sense it's been infiltrated by those who profess to be part of this neoconservative ideology. And it does not seem that the idea of diplomacy comes into their vocabulary. I think they perceive the world as being a win-at-all-costs arena, and that it's one in which people must be subdued. There's absolutely no room for discussion, and that's why we have this fully charged, decades-long policy of fomenting covert and overt wars, implementing and imposing a regime of sanctions on different nation states. And I think it's that is very sad because it provides a very unfortunate impediments in terms of attaining mutual security and coexistence for all, right, and the freedom of trade and diplomatic relations.
Yeah, it's very interesting, Garland. I mean, it was codified in the mid 70s with the Helsinki process of the indivisibility of security, meaning everybody, you can't aggregate security towards yourself at the expense of another state. And so that's why we have the term indivisibility of security. And they went along with it. It worked at the height of the Cold War. But as we heard from our guest in London, even considering that, considering the term diplomacy, negotiation, means compromise. And compromise is a dirty word for these people. Garland in Washington.
Yes, because what we're looking at is a group of individuals who talk about a U.S.-led war. At times, they mention it as the U.S.-led war order. At other times, they refer to it as the rules-based international order. But it simply means U.S. hegemony. And the contradiction we have now is that the U.S. empire has to talk to the world with a cover story of acting in the best interest of all, of trying to maintain an order that's in the best interest of all. However, this so-called order has to be imposed on the world using coercive means. So if this order must be imposed on the world, then it's clear that by its very nature, it is an aggressive and coercive nature. And that's what's going on right now. And the allies or vassals or colonies of the U.S. empire are paying the price. They're being sacrificed at the altar of this world order.
Yep, they're sacrificing their very good friends. And there's scant regard for Ukrainians. That's what's really ironic about it. Anthony, what is very interesting as well is that NATO says constantly, and there was an interview with Stoltenberg with the Washington Post a few days ago, NATO doesn't want to escalate. But that's all NATO does, is escalate. You know, at one point, you know, a certain kind of tanks were not allowed. Now they're there. Now these long-range missiles primarily come from the UK, and the U.S. will most likely follow the U.K.'s lead here. They constantly escalate, though they claim that they do not want to do that. The NATO is Orwellian in nature. Go ahead, in Worthing.
Yes, I agree with what you said. In fact, there's been no efforts at all for peace. In fact, April a year ago, Boris Johnson went over to the Ukraine and scuppered the pending peace deal between the Ukraine and Russia. And since then, hundreds of thousands of war casualties have been, many, many killed. There's been more wrecking of the whole of Ukraine because of the continued conflict. And the supply of this heavy weaponry is absolutely excessive because, to start with, we were told in the UK, the weapons we were giving are only defensive, but in fact, already some of the weaponry we've supplied have killed and injured civilians in the eastern Ukraine, which of course are voted to become part of Russia. And I think what is missing in all of this is that the NATO countries are not acting in the best interests of their members. And the United Kingdom government, which has started this policy of intervening in the Ukraine conflict from day one, has got absolutely no mandate from its public to do that sort of thing. And there's been amazing damage done to the British economy, and no debate about the UK government's Ukraine and Russian policies. And it's excessive. We're talking about disclosed military aid so far of well over 5 billion, but we don't know what the undisclosed factor is. But we also need to look at what is the damage to UK foreign policy by them intervening in Ukraine, because we've seen the reduced influence which the United Kingdom is getting in the world because of this policy, and we've seen that it's forced Russia to become more close to communist China. And of course, we have to look at what have we got in common with Ukraine, because we're told that they're defending so-called our values, our democratic values. But we know they've shut down opposition parties, they've shut down opposition media, and they've even shut down the Orthodox Church.
Well, and Anthony, on top of it, it looks like they're going to cancel the next round of elections in the country. Okay, you know, Western values here. You know, let's go back to the Inca in London. One of the things that perplexes me so much here is that how is this really, in fact, helping Ukraine? You have millions and millions of people have fled the country. The country's GDP is in a free fall. Industrial capacity is almost zero. And they're basically a welfare state or a client state of the West right now. I can't see how this great effort to save Ukraine is actually doing anything for the Ukrainian people. And again, like I said already in this program, this conflict will end one day. But what will be left of that country? Go ahead, in London.
Well, most likely, Ukraine is going to be dismembered. It's obviously clear that the interests of the Ukrainian people are not had at heart by the American-led alliance. It's not held at heart by the Ukrainian elites themselves, who plunder and pilfer from the economy. That was the modus operandi right from the beginning. It's always had an issue with corruption. And certainly after the 2014 coup d'etat,
rather than a revolution of dignity. It was a coup d'etat. You had, you know, the it was always predicted that the American arm of capitalism and corporate power would infiltrate Ukraine to give it a shock treatment and exploit that country. So in all that time, notwithstanding the war that was happening in the Donbass, you have a situation where Ukraine's economy has been totally, you know, has been continually degraded and stultified, despite this supposed idea that Ukraine wants to become more open, more modern, more Western. It's actually regressed. And I think this particular phase of the conflict, because it is a phase, it didn't start in February of 2022. It's been an ongoing hybrid war with a military dimension, with an economic dimension, and informational dimension. And unfortunately, each of these strands have not helped Ukraine. By militarily threatening to intimidate Russia, putting a knife to the guts, literally, of Russia, you are not doing any favors to that country who you are using for that role. Similarly, when it comes to the economics of it, it's all about being about plunder. And one development, of course, since this new phase of the special military operation and the Russian intervention, has been the introduction of the likes of BlackRock, whose role would essentially only be there.
Well, we're going to go to a break, gentlemen, but I think Hunter Biden was, he led the path. You know, he was a trailblazer for all of this here. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on NATO's illusion. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing NATO's illusions. Okay, let's go back to Garland in Washington. If there's a silver lining in all of this, Garland, in this really dreadful situation, is that NATO has taken it upon itself to say this is existential. It's to be or not to be. Well, I'll take those odds, okay? I mean, if it's all in on Ukraine, that's what's going to make or break NATO. I'll take that bet, okay? And they've made this craven choice. They didn't have to do it, okay? Ukraine is of no strategic value whatsoever to the European Union at all, okay? But they've made it that way, so game on, Garland.
Well, and what I just identified is that the security necessities and needs of the European Union do not align with the U.S. empire, who are their political and economic masters. So we have a contradiction between the leaders and those that are led. Certainly, to be quite frank, it's obvious that Russia's security needs aligns quite well with the European security needs. They have a border, they have trade, etc. The United States looks at it from a geopolitical perspective. How do they maintain power over both Europe and Russia? So part of the dynamic I hear, unfortunately, that the European Union can't and won't address is that part of what the U.S. empire is doing is to ensure that Europe's in a position where they can't challenge the U.S. on a world stage economically, and they can't push back either diplomatically or politically. They have to do what they're told, even though it's not in their best interest. And to me, that's the big dynamic, as is exposed by the Nord Stream, the Nord Stream bombing.
Yeah, which, they can find, in the United States, they can find pensioners with walkers in a wheelchair that were close to the Capitol on January 6th, but they don't know who blew up the Nord Stream pipelines. I think that's kind of interesting here. Anthony, staying with something that Garland had to say, what I think is really remarkable, that if you look at public opinion across the Western world, this war in Ukraine is an elite project. This is not a popular thing. I mean, the media can and parrot the powers that be all they want. But, you know, they go to great lengths to censor RT and other opposition and independent voices. It's not a popular thing. This is an elite agenda. And you can see it in Germany, okay? You have Annalena Baerbock. I don't care what my voters say. This is an elite agenda. Go ahead, and Worthing.
Right. Well, unfortunately, NATO is not even representing its own members, and their interests are being very much let down. But we have got a problem where debate is being shut down, and if we had any debate at all, it would reveal that there are no arguments whatsoever for NATO to be involved in the Ukraine. So it's a very sort of sad situation. The UK Prime Minister just said that he wants to be involved in the reconstruction of the Ukraine, and that's assuming there will be some sort of Ukraine to reconstruct, all sort of pie in the sky, because it's already estimated that the costs of rebuilding are in the region of $750 billion, and I hope he's not expecting the UK taxpayer to get involved in that, because, of course, the UK taxpayer has suffered horrendously, because we would have all our public sector strikes resolved by now if the money had been spent on paying people a reasonable wage instead of spending money on warmongering in Ukraine. And we've had huge effects, like the rise in the interest rates have gone up 4% since the government decided on their policies on Ukraine and Russia. We've had horrendous rising prices, the effects of energy costs, which will continue to worsen. And the problem with these opinion polls you mentioned is they are doctored. So if we actually had direct answers, direct questions, the opinions would be even more against the UK being involved and other Western European countries. But the problem is all of these countries are not acting in the interests of their citizens. They're making their citizens poor to support this war effort. And at some stage, this cannot continue. At some stage, the citizens are going to say, enough is enough, we're fed up, and
Well, Anthony, I'm a little more pessimistic on that, because we saw what they did with COVID. In many ways, that was a dry run. So what you can do to, yes, to locking people down, quite literally, and then locking down debate. Let's go back to our guest in London. It's already been mentioned on this program. I think it's very interesting. And they talk about reconstruction and no negotiation and all that. Well, I mean, they always forget the other side of the equation is Russia's interests. And so since NATO will not recognize that Russia has any security interests whatsoever, and it's been, and European leaders have been challenged about this. What about Russia? Russia has no interest, you know, during this conflict in Ukraine. Well, that is a very, very dangerous thing to say, because it gives the policymakers in the Kremlin say, well, then we're just going to do what we're going to do because there's nobody to talk to. See, this whole approach is so dangerous for peace on the continent and maybe widening the war. But if you're not going to willingly negotiate and you're going to talk, then the conflict is going to end when Russia says it's over. Go ahead, in London.
Yes, I think it's already been alluded to that the European leaders are not acting in the interests of their people. And this refusal by the US-led West not to recognize Russia's interests, not as a selfishly motivated matter, but something that is more all-encompassing, that involves Europe as well.
Right.
It's very sad and unfortunate. I think the basis of a security architecture in Europe was missed in the immediate aftermath of the ending of the ideological Cold War. But that's a kind of a more realistic template would be to recognize mutual economic and security interests and not to play this game, this power
this power game of trying to subjugate a power such as Russia, which really is going to be a thankless thing, and it's something that would, and it's obviously its ultimate conclusion would be a doomsday scenario. One hopes that it may seem like something not apparent in the horizon or realistic in the horizon, but what is really needed here to break this deadlock is about there being European leaders of a stronger fiber who can actually present the case, as they did at one a time in history, that they recognized Russia's legitimate interest, whether it was a Soviet state or a post-Soviet state. You had Ostpolitik, and there's nobody in Europe, certainly in Germany, from where that phrase and that methodology originates from, there's nobody who's proselytizing that, that you need to guarantee everybody's security interests. Using one state against another is simply not good statescraft. It's actually very, very.
What has happened here is, Garland, what we heard from our guests in London is spot on. Is that you have this with the NATO expansion to the east? Its center of gravity has moved east as well. So you have countries like Poland, and you have the Baltic republics. They're the ones that are tilting the scales more. The old Europe, you know, Germany and France, you know, where they this is where European security was anchored. There have been sidelines or allowed themselves to be silent. I mean, I don't call him Chancellor Schultz. I call him Sergeant Schultz. I mean, this guy, that, you know, he, when you think of some of the great chancellors Germany's had since the Second World War, this guy is a dwarf. I mean, it's incredible to watch these people denigrate their own political stability and disregard and hold in contempt their electorate. Go ahead, Garland.
Yes, and what they don't realize also is that this affects the view of Europe from the world. One of the reasons
Absolutely.
That Africa, the Middle East, Latin America, most of the world is gravitating towards Russia in this conflict is not just because of the history of colonialism from the European powers. That's certainly a factor. But as the world leaders look at the fecklessness of the European leaders today, and they look at their vassalages towards towards the United States, they have no respect for them. They have gained no respect from around the world. And traditional societies where respect is very important, particularly for leaders, look at these people and some of the cultural craziness that they're trying to enforce, and they say, we just don't want any parts of this. We'll go with a more traditional society that at least has some respect for itself and who means what it says and says what it means, other than the European vassalage, which are just double talkers and say what they're told by the Biden administration.
Yeah, Anthony, I'm glad this was brought up, Garland, because this is something that I've been watching very closely, and this is a societal conflict. This is civilizational, that Russia represents a civilization that is antithetical in the minds of the people in the West, and this is one of the reasons why they despise Russia. It's a conservative place. Go ahead, Anthony.
I think more and more people in the United Kingdom and Western Europe are realizing that maybe Russia has more values in tune with what people support than they're told by the government. And, of course, Russia is a democratic country, a Christian country, which also, like the United Kingdom, accepts other faiths. So I think at some stage, hopefully people will wake up and realize that they're fed a lot of propaganda. But we have to look at this reputation issue, because the reputation of NATO and America and the United Kingdom went down when there was the great betrayal of 26 million Afghans when they did a so-called deal with the devil, with the Taliban. And yet that appears to be so they could have got involved with the Ukraine. Now,
I have to jump in here, gentlemen. We've run out of time. We've had a fascinating discussion. I want to thank my guests in Washington, Worthing, and in London. And I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, crosstalk rules.